instead of having a human flick through 400 pages of medical jargon and notes, why don't we have an AI or an AI kind of agent or something summarize that, extract all the clinical insights that are relevant and match them up so that you can have a kind of a very quick review where you as a human focus on the bits that you're best at, that kind of like the tip of the spear clinical decision point, and the rest is just abstracted away from you.
Welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast, where you can learn from entrepreneurs and investors who are driving progress in healthcare and life science around the globe. Admin tasks cost the U.S. healthcare system over $1 trillion annually. That's a staggering number. That's not only a financial burden, but also takes away from the time doctors and nurses spend with patients, creating a drag on quality of care. I'm Alex Merwin from AWS, and today I am thrilled to welcome Abdel Mahmoud, CEO and co-founder of Interior, to the pod to talk about their mission to unburden doctors and nurses of such administrative burdens. He shares how Interior's generative AI technology is changing the game for healthcare professionals, starting with transforming the prior authorization process. I hope you'll enjoy this one as much as I did. Let's go. Welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. I am thrilled to be joined today by Abdel Mahmoud, the CEO and co-founder of Interior. Abdel, how are you doing today?
Yeah, great. Lovely to meet you, Alex, and I'm excited to be on.
And tell me, where are you dialing in from?
Currently, London, in our London office, yeah.
Okay, and why do you say currently? Are you spending a lot of time elsewhere?
Yeah, so our actual HQ is in New York. I just came back from there yesterday. But a lot of our AI engineering is in London. When I'm here, I'm more mentally slow as I try to catch up with what magic they're cooking up here.
What have you found different between the ecosystems in London and New York?
Depending on the perspective you look at it, some has pros and the other has cons. I would say from a founding perspective and access to capital and the kind of the other stuff outside of just hiring, New York is better in the sense that US is often better for that, for the startup ecosystem. But from a kind of a quality of talent, especially in AI engineering, I think London is unparalleled. A lot of AI companies that may start in San Francisco, if they expand, they often expand to London, or I think Paris is another one that's coming up. So you really get some high quality, fantastic people to work with here. But the other one to probably call out as to why New York is important for us is we only sell to US healthcare, and I'm sure we'll get into that. But our customers are just in the US, and US customers like to buy from companies based in the US. So it makes life easier that way.
Yeah, being on both sides of the pond is really helpful. So can you tell me a little bit about Interior and what you all do?
Yeah, absolutely. So Interior is an AI company, and the mission is we want to lift the $1 trillion burden of administration that's plaguing US healthcare at the moment. What that looks like is a lot of these processes, think of them as back office processes that for someone to get the right care at the right time, a lot of stuff has to happen. A lot of information passed back and forth between the multiple stakeholders in healthcare, whether it's a hospital or a clinic or the health insurance company. And that's ballooned into $1 trillion of just the kind of information and bureaucracy and processes. A lot of that, as you can imagine, is just dealing with unstructured data, moving it from place to place and repeating these kind of standard routines and workflows. And we make those faster. We try to abstract away all the boring stuff, we call it. So people working in healthcare, and in particular in health insurance, making their lives easier, making processes faster so people get the right care at the right time.
And can you share an example of what that looks like?
Absolutely. I'll start with the example that we first started with, which was prior authorization. So for those not familiar with prior authorization, it's a process that's an important process. If you put it into Google search, you'll hear a lot of complaints about it from different people. And all it is, it's in the name, prior authorization. So when you want to get access to care in the US, for example, and you go to your doctor and your doctor wants to do a procedure, that's $30,000. Someone's going to be paying for that. And it's typically a health insurer. So that provider, that doctor, so to speak, will have to ask permission before they book you in for that procedure. And that kind of request lands at the desk of an insurance company. And if you place yourself in the shoes of an insurance company, how do you decide if someone needs a $30,000 procedure? You need to ask for some clinical data. Have you tried physiotherapy? Have you tried over-the-counter medications first? Have you tried lower cost therapy? That's often better before we jump into something that's serious. So there's a lot of back and forth information that's shared between the provider and the payer while the patient is waiting for that procedure that their doctor has wants to do. And it's just about the insurance company getting to that right decision and getting there fast, but they're slowed down by fax machines and voice notes and voicemails. That's the standard at which information is transferred to these stakeholders. So where we started with that, which was, how do I, instead of having a human flick through 400 pages of medical jargon and notes. Why don't you have an AI or an AI kind of agent or something summarize that, extract all the clinical insights that are relevant and match them up so that you can have a kind of a very quick review where you as a human focus on the bits that you're best at, that kind of like the tip of the spear clinical decision point, and the rest is just abstracted away from you. That's an example.
Great. We're going to get there step by step because I'm really excited to learn about how you differentiate clinically relevant versus non-relevant, and all these things become really meaningful from like a ring fencing and a training and a validation perspective. So that, again, we're just hanging out here and we're getting warmed up, which is great. Maybe you can just tell, who are you? Where are you from? You can go back as long as you want. Really, what's the story of what brought you to this point in founding Interior? It's crazy to found a health tech. There's been some data going around about the exit market. Most do it because we're mission driven, but what's your mission personally?
Yeah, no, I'm definitely learning how crazy it is as I go along. I think sometimes you have to be a bit naive or foolish to jump into it. So yeah, no, taking it way back, I was born in North Africa, in a place called Libya, actually. And I came to the UK as a migrant when I was young and grew up in London, in North London in particular. And I followed the typical pleasing your parents immigrant starter pack, which is go to medical school and get a respectable degree. And so went along that path. And at some point during the practice of medicine or kind of studying for medicine, which in the UK is an undergraduate degree, in the US it's more of a later stage thing, I realized a few things, which was that healthcare felt frustrating. It wasn't what you thought you signed up for, helping people, intervening at the kind of the most vulnerable points of their life and making their lives better. There was a bit of that, but it was 5%. The vast majority of it was just processes and bureaucracy and burnout and all these things that we hear in the news these days. And I remember thinking that a lot of the times when there's a patient in the room, there was a series of things that happened over the last 3 or 4 years that if just any intervention at any one point could have prevented them being in that room. I realized a lot of the solutions, this problems just generally in healthcare could have been solved way more upstream. And that got me interested in systems, interested in technology, and how do we leverage that to stop people being in that room in the first place. And I'd been building stupid stuff on the internet as a teenager in printer programming, which I'd put aside until about a couple of years of med school, where I realized that actually probably one of the biggest ways you can have an impact in healthcare is going to be by leveraging some of those skills. So I took some time out to do a master's in computer science at the time. And it was at the same university that I'd studied medicine in. And I was able to convince them that I thought I could program good enough to get in. Turned out to be a lot of maths. I'm not more good at maths. Anyway, and that's what started my kind of journey in health tech. During that time, I incubated a company inside Facebook. They had an accelerator in London and we were trying to build chatbots for medical education. This was about 3 or 4 years ago. So before chatbots like feel like magic now, back then they felt like magic, but they were really fragile and brittle and kind of these rules-based decision systems. So I had my first taste of trying to build something. It never spun out. It never became a company, but it was a cool technology. And then some time in academia. And that was interesting because I was working on a project at UCL where they'd built this AI. It's a pretty awesome kind of computer vision algorithm that can detect these cancerous growths on cameras that you put into your body. And I was just like an intern analyst over the summer there. But it took them 4 years to commercialize. And that was my other lesson, which was, if I ever build something in healthcare, how do you just make money and get it out into the world before 4 years, right? 4 years felt too long. And then eventually went back to medicine, graduated as a doctor, and then Google came knocking with an offer. And sadly, in the UK, the state of affairs is, if you join Google, you'll be paid about 5 times as much if you were a junior doctor and you could work in things of impact. So I joined Google and I was there for a year. And I enjoyed my time there. I learned a lot about product and working with high caliber engineers. And then the bug of entrepreneurship got me again. And I left to start Interior. So that was the journey as to how a series of lessons along the way as to what kind of led me to working on this kind of nitty gritty administration part of healthcare.
How was the culture at Google different than the culture when you worked as a practicing clinician?
You mean the free coffees, the lunch, the fact that you have a seat at lunchtime?
The willingness to try new things, curiosity about technology, were there meaningful differences?
No, absolutely. They're two worlds apart. Sadly, a lot of it in healthcare, you have to look at it from the lens of, it's just a resource constrained system. There's just not enough to go around. So you use humans as like these kind of, because these resources, you don't treat them as like an investable asset, so to speak. And you're just working late, the systems work against you, it feels, and everyone's just... It's not a healthy environment, sadly, because of many other factors, politics, economics, and all that kind of stuff we don't need to get into. So from that perspective, it wasn't a great environment. But from the perspective of like hard work, grit, putting patients first, despite all of that, despite being tired and not having time to have lunch, you you still see the kind of the empathy that clinicians have and the care for the patients and doing things right, right? And I think that's not always there in startups, not always there in technology. And I think that was something that I try to cultivate in our company today, and a lot of our companies, clinicians as well. But the other thing about Google is just this, nothing feels impossible. You know, move fast, try to build things and learn through iteration. You can't always do that in healthcare, right? Sometimes a faulty iteration is actually harming someone. So that's another caveat to keep in mind.
So let's talk a little bit more about the current products. You shared this use case of prior auth, and you mentioned that there was a surgery example, what you were saying. And the old axiom is surgeons want to cut, especially in a fee-for-service paradigm like the US, which it's not completely fair, but I'm gonna say it's a solidly half-fair statement. And so the insurer in that case, they're not just about penny-pinching and saving costs. Like, it's about decreasing the total cost of care for the patient. And that frequently will involve interventions that are lower risk. And can you share a little bit more about how can AI used for administrative tasks have an impact on clinical quality?
Yes. And I think I usually take it back to, if you look at the incentives of US healthcare, now you hear a lot of rubbish about US healthcare and it's terrible and it's broken, and it is in many ways. But actually at its core, it's actually a well-designed system, which is that providers are incentivized to just get the best care for their patients. Period. No matter the cost, they should just focus on the best treatment for you and try to get you that. And health insurers, they have to pay for that care. So they have this other incentive of, how do I give you the best care at the lowest cost? And what often that means is actually, it's proactive care, right? Because if you've paid the premiums and I've calculated your risk, right? And you have diabetes, let's say, hopefully not, but you should have diabetes. And I've calculated your risk and you're paying me premiums, I have every incentive as a health insurer now to keep you as healthy as possible so you don't cost more, right? So at its core, the incentives seem great. I think where it falls apart is the administration layer. Like, how do you actually know what to do and when to do it to keep someone to be proactive rather than reactive? So because of the fact that information isn't shared as possible, as seamlessly as possible, and there's a lot of these processes, what you end up happening is health plans just being reactive. When some big cost comes up, hey, someone wants to get this $100,000 procedure or service, you're like, no, stop, I need to do these checks. And sometimes that leads to malpractice in some cases. And same on the physician side, right? Sometimes they don't think of the cost of care and just say, oh, we'll just give you all the scans, right? We'll give you an MRI, a CT, an angiogram, whatever. When in reality, you only needed one. The rest were just unnecessary costs, right? So at its core, you want the highest ROI of quality for the money spent, right? Otherwise, you just end up with ballooning costs as we see in US healthcare. So I think it's a great system, but the crux of it is, how do you help health insurers making these decisions, make them as efficiently and as fast as possible so they can be a bit more proactive rather than reactive?
And tell me about some of the other products you're developing. So you mentioned prior auth. Where are you focusing right now for administrative burden, and what products are you selling?
Yes. So when you look at a health plan today or health insurance company, there is many functions, departments that all come together to make up this idea of a health plan that someone has coverage for the healthcare. Prior authorization is one. But other areas, such as, for example, underwriting, right? So when you take on a new population that you want to calculate their risk and then say what their premiums are, you have to understand how healthy they are and how unhealthy they are. And then that way you can balance your costs. That's one department, right? Another one is, for example, is payment integrity. So that's the flip side of prior auth, where someone requests permission to get this procedure. They go into the hospital, maybe they deteriorate and they have a few more complications and a few more surgeries and so on. When that bill, that claim lands at the health insurer, they have to check that everything they authorized actually happened, and the stuff that was new, how do we understand what did it actually happen, is called payment integrity, right? So all these areas, there's many more. We noticed this common theme across all of them, which was the hardest part was the clinical decisioning. So people think clinical decisioning happens in the hospital. It does. But as a health plan, you have to understand a lot of clinical data about your members, because everything you do is around clinical data. And that's often very unstructured data that's jargon heavy. So you can't have a 21-year-old business analyst like you do in other businesses review this data. You often need an expensive jargon understander, sadly a nurse or a doctor. And so we've realized that hundreds of thousands of clinicians, pharmacists, doctors, nurses, that we're in a shortage of generally working full-time inside health insurance companies, like full-time desk jobs reviewing clinical data on Excel spreadsheets and faxes. And it didn't make sense, right? We're going to be short something like 3 million nurses in about 15 years. And why are like hundreds of thousands of them working in a desk job? And when we looked at that, we realized this layer of clinical decision support, plans need to make decisions. And they bring in these people to do that. But there's no other kind of regulatory reason why. There's no other, for example, outcome why. It's just about getting them the right decision, right? Should I pay for this or not? What is the risk I'm taking on? And that's the insight we had, which is if I can ingest all this unstructured clinical data, right? And GPT-4 off the bat can do USMLE exams and be better than a doctor and so on, right? Maybe not ready for prime time AI doctor, but they can understand clinical jargon. So if you can ingest all that unstructured data and then surface those insights to help a clinician today that's doing an admin job inside a health plan, instead of do 10 review items a day, maybe get to 20 and 30 because they're not spending their time scrolling through endless information, looking for needles in a haystack, all of a sudden you can unlock that. So we started with prior auth, but then the same stack we use, and I'm happy to double click on that, we realized actually applies to payment integrity and risk adjustment because one of our modules is ingesting unstructured clinical data and then understanding it. Then you can put these other workflows on top. And all of a sudden, a point solution, one product, prior authorization reviews, a copilot, all of a sudden can expand out to all these other functions where clinical data flows through to deliver a decision or something inside a health plan.
And from a regulatory perspective, this is not a medical device. It's not even a clinical decision support tool because the intervention was requested by the credentialed healthcare professional, right?
Absolutely.
And so that's where regulatory scrutiny would apply. And this is ops within the payer. Am I correct in understanding that?
Yes.
So the really like success looks like, you know, probably doing a retrospective study, not having like erroneous judgments. So have you done any of that validation? How do you, you mentioned GPT-4, obviously Anthropic has their models, Llama has open source models, Mistral out of France, like there's many. How do you approach deciding, because it sounds like a real core piece of your technology is using the LLM to assemble, for lack of a better term, a patient portrait, pulling all the data for the EMR and the clinical data. It's something that's more easily interpretable by the person making the decision at the payer. So how do you test the performance of the LLMs you're using and ensuring that it's improving over time? And how do you think about testing new models?
Absolutely. I think this is a whole big area that many companies across anyone working with LLMs does that. And just to add a caveat to my last comment around there's no regulatory and so on, there is, right? In the sense of if the payer is about to deny care, then all of a sudden that's going to impact someone. That's where it has to be escalated to a human physician. And I think that shouldn't go away. The issue is that's only 3-4% of all requests for prior authorization. Generally, providers make the right decisions. It's going through all that sludge and that the bits that are approval that the AI can do and can approve and document and audit without human having to look at it, but escalating to a human physician. So just to call that out. But regardless, when you're making decisions using clinical data, CHI, sensitive information about patients and members and so on, you need to take care. And it is way more, it's not AI doctor in the sense like you're liable for their care, but it's still, you have to take care. And you can easily kind of be laissez-faire about this and it comes back to bite you. Now, part of that is evaluations. Part of that is setting up guardrails and so on. So where to begin with evaluations? I think everything that we do today is evaluated. So we have pipelines, right? So we have these kind of three core engines. So one is about ingesting, like I said, unstructured clinical data. Another one is about ingesting processes and guidelines, like human written rules that are readable by humans, but not by systems. And how do you get an AI to be able to necessarily just convert that into a series of steps or actions to do? And then clinical reasoning, which is basically given a question and some context about the clinical information, getting to an answer and then citing that and documenting why and so on. Those three components are all pipelines in and of themselves with multiple large language model calls. And each one has a different evaluation framework and evaluation set. So for example, taking clinical reasoning, for example. So in this case, it's you have a question, pain affecting this patient's life significantly for the last 6 months. Now, that's a loaded question. There's a temporal aspect to it over the last 6 months and so on. So the way we do that is like we construct queries, so to speak, and then we execute those queries, retrieve information, clinical information, and then reason through to get to a decision. Now, each one of those steps, we gather, we have kind of data sets called ground truths. So we have actual human clinicians go through and generate a set of ground truths that every time we make a modification to the pipeline, we just run an automated eval where we say, oh, for part one of this process, for example, we actually saw a regression. So we need to like not run that model. And we also have testing continuously in the background, right? So even when the product is live, trying to catch mistakes and so on ourselves. So it's all about regular testing, regular evaluation, and everything being as data-driven as possible. That's hard when you start out. So a lot of times, our first eval sets are like, you know, 10, N of 10. But you have to start somewhere and then build over time. You build the muscle of evaluation and also the culture of evaluation. Because sometimes, and just to finish the point here, if you don't have a culture of evaluation, you end up having people suggesting ideas, improvements to pipelines, but it's all subjective. So you get one AI engineer with a perspective of we take it this way or that way, and people just end up arguing and not getting to push the ball forward. So you have to define what success even looks like. And that's, again, through evaluations.
And Abdel, how did you limit the scope of this problem at the very beginning? Like, the 0 to 1 is always super fascinating to me, right? Because you just said you had 10 cases at the start. And so, I mean, did you limit the number of payers you were working with? Did you limit your patient cohorts? Did you limit pre-auth the certain type of interventions? Like, how did you get started when you were at the very beginning of validating the solution? Even building, like you mentioned, you had 3 engines. Probably not at the start, right? You probably maybe had 1 or 5, or you probably had to work into that. So what did it look like at the very beginning, and how did you approach those challenges?
Yes. All of those were very limited at the start, scoped down as much as possible. Some without choice. We didn't have any insurance companies wanting to work with us when we first started. So, you know, you have to earn the trust of a large enterprise. So some of that was just the first one that said yes, we were like, let's go get it. So that was one aspect. Honestly, the first version of this, when it was just me and my co-founder, Zahid, was like, this was back in maybe April last year. It was a basic rag chapel. Right? Like, mm-hmm. Just start with that. Take the
fact. Can you define what that means?
Yeah. So retrieval augmented generation, effectively. And what that means is, let's say you have a 300-page clinical record, right? And it's a PDF. Can I have something that extracts all the text out of that and then chunks it somewhat crudely at the start? So it breaks it all into these paragraphs or things and then turns it into a mathematical representation, effectively, and then stores it in a database. And then when a question comes, which is often taking some policy document, which says, check for these 3 things to approve this procedure. So one is check that they've had an MRI scan. We then do this query where we turn that sentence into a number and then check how similar it is across these 100 chunks and then retrieve them and then pass it all to a large language model to say, hey, there's some evidence and context, clinical record context, and there's this question, answer it. This is something 2 people at Hackathon these days can build about 3 hours, right? But the goal was to get something out there. And another thing to touch on about limiting the scope is, initially, we thought this could be an automated process without a human in the loop. We thought this is the promise, right? No human has to do it. No change management. It's AI. It gets a decision out there. We realized we're going to shoot ourselves in the foot, because same with self-driving cars today can probably drive better than humans, but they're still not out on the street, right? Like, we have a certain standard where if you set yourself up where you're autonomous, people expect 100%, and nothing's 100% today. So what we set the expectation of, hey, look, it may be 30% accurate, it may be 50% accurate, it may be 60% accurate. But the one thing I can promise you, though, is it will be faster. So that even if it didn't get the question, it can point to the 4 paragraphs that the answer was going to be and then show them to you so that you can quickly pick up from where it left off. And that was a key thing about making sure we had something that was valuable to the customer. They could use it day one, even though accuracy was not great.
If you can show an uplift of 15% in approval times, and I have an organization of 1,000 clinical reviewers, then that's the equivalent of 100 to 150 headcount annualized. So even if it's not perfect, if it helps a little bit, and then if you do get the accuracy up, so that 15% becomes like 20 or 25, it becomes very meaningful. That's interesting.
Like today, our first customer, and all of them, measured the nurse's productivity by number of reviews a day. And they had a number. They've been tracking it for 10 years. It's an average of 10.5 reviews per day for outpatient cases for this organization. So we just built this very rudimentary tool, gave it to them. And all it was just saving them scroll. It's a better PDF search. That's what we promised, right? But at the end of the day, we just tracked, right? So that nurse was averaging 13. Now they're averaging 20. Good. Now, and then as we're gathering data, we're gathering improvements, all these micro things, the pipeline gets more and more complex and more calls. And then you start to notice that the number keeps going up. And that's internally what we measure. The number of cases a nurse can do in a day. Clinical quality is an aspect of that, but it's always a human in the loop. And the UX is another whole aspect of this as well. But it's about keeping that number go up, because that's where the value for the enterprise is at the end of the day.
How important is the UX, right? So we talked about model baselining, but really you're augmenting a person in their interaction with the models. What have you learned about how important annotation tools, like the interaction with the technology, what am I thinking of, like multi-shot learning, things like that? What have you learned about including the user in delivering against job to be done for interior?
The short answer is humans are lazy. And that's the biggest learning.
Hey, speak for yourself.
It's this kind of idea of the same way that Tesla says autonomous self-driving, but keep your finger in the wheel every 30 seconds to make sure you're actually awake. And what I mean by that is, so as the product got more complex and we spent a lot of time on the AI, improving retrieval, improving precision, accuracy, recall, whatever, right? But the UX was very simple. It was just, we'd extract out this evidence and then just give you a decision and then show you the chain of thought to that decision. And it was just a big blocks of text, right? Now, that blocks of text was useful. It was maybe 85% accurate. It was very relevant. And we'd have citations. You just double click and you open it up and so on. No one clicked the citations. Mm. And that's a problem, right? Because you know these models are not perfect and you need that human input.
You're counting on it. And if they don't do it, then you're going to have a different problem with your customers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Humans go, it looks right. I kid you not, the last 6 months, the most of our advancements have been on the UX, which is about how do you take this huge amounts of information and just distill it into the three bits that I need you as an AI to check as an expert human without overloading. So almost like we put a design challenge for ourselves, which is a nurse at the end of our kind of the journey with this product, a nurse should be able to do a review in 3 taps on her phone, his or her phone, on the way to work. Now, they're not going to be actually doing it on their phone, but that design constraint, they're going to lose focus. Just what is the minimum set of interactions where you can ensure that your AI output is going to agree with what the human expert is. Like keeping them, the gamification goes into it. Everything goes into it about like tap, but they can catch errors. And then that's been the crux of it, effectively.
I laughed and when you said humans are lazy, but in the early days of Amazon, this was something that Bezos just would not let down. Everyone will always want stuff for cheaper. Everyone will always want more stuff. Everyone will always want stuff to get here faster. It's really not more complicated. And it's an exercise of keeping the main thing. And it's really hard in our industry to stay crisp and clear on the job to be done. And like your job to be done is, like, I'm not going to say let people be more lazy, but to make it easier for them. And that's just so interesting. We talked about, you mentioned in passing that the V1 MVP was a heed, something you could have put together in a weekend hackathon with a bunch of pizza. Obviously, now you need to think about developing a broader moat. You've brought on significant investment and you've scaled the business. Can you tell me a little bit about the fundraising journey and how you picked the investors you've partnered with and how you're thinking about securing future growth and creating competitive differentiation and really advancing beyond something which could be created through Fancy Rag, right? And like how you're up-leveling in that way.
Yes. A few questions to unpack there. So starting with the fundraising journey, we did an accelerator. So me and Zahid, we did a kind of a US-based accelerator called Neo, and it was 500,000 or so. And an idea that was not really crystallized and just, hey, we could build stuff. We're going to go figure it out. And it took us about 6 to 8 months of throwing a lot of stuff up the walls. At some point, we were building an AI tool for GPs in the UK. We went outside of healthcare a little bit. We're just experimenting, right? And then we ended up narrowing down on this kind of particular pain point of prior authorization for US health insurance. And that was around about kind of April, May time, where we'd built this kind of very MVP tool and we somehow convinced a large enterprise to be a design partner and to try it out, despite having no name, no reputation, just me and my co-founder. And they said yes. And Tobias asked time and said, hey, we first need to just shadow your nurses to like, we didn't even understand what the workflow really looked like. We needed a theory. So after a bunch of that, we realized, oh, there's a lot more to build. It's not just read a medical record and a guideline. There's all these integrations, all these standards that already exist. It's a whole language to this industry when you look behind the curtain. And that's when we realized we're going to need more people. And some of these people are going to be quite expensive, AI engineers and a bit of sales support and even operations support, that kind of stuff. So we had enough traction, enough interest from enterprises. No one had signed anything because some of these sales cycles are quite long, but there was enough from there to say, if you do X, Y, and Z, we will pay quite a lucrative contract for this. And with that, we went out to fundraise the seed and we spoke to a lot of funds. And I think there's a lot more I can comment on about here. At this stage, there's not many VCs that are the best for this stage, which is an idea, a team that can ship fast and an interested customer. It could all fall apart in 6 months, right? So you need the kind of right appetite for this. And then we were fortunate to meet George and Luciana from Sequoia, who are a European team actually, but they took a bet on us and we raised our seed round then. That seed capital is about kind of $3 million or so. And we're able to bring quite reputable angels along the way as well. And the founder of Google DeepMind, Mustafa, and a few other kind of healthcare founders. And really just optimized for people that either understand AI or people that understand healthcare. So one large institutional fund, so to speak, and the rest were really just operators. And operators where I knew I could go to them for something. They're not going to help you with everything, but they're just going to help you with one thing. There's this person called Ali Islami, DeepMind, who is head of a lot of the evaluations there at Google. And he's just been great for that one thing. Like, how do you do evaluations? So that's been great. And that was around about the time of the seed. The first thing we did was hire a few more engineers so I can get away from coding, and that's better for the product quality and better for everything generally. And I could focus more on customer support, go-to-market operations. So we built out a team of about five, six people, roughly, over the coming months, and added two or three more design partners and started building, started productionizing, getting the regulatory compliance needed, high trust, HIPAA certifications, and so on. You'd be surprised how much those cost as well. So it's quite prohibitive sometimes for an early stage company. And around about November time, something changed where we started to get some usage, live usage of our tool, some customers that are talking to other customers about it. And then all of a sudden, that pipeline just exploded in a sense, right? And we noticed the crux of this was just in healthcare, they're like lemmings, where no one wants to be the first. They just want to be the third to be the first, right? So in a sense, after you have two or three that are using it and can say, hey, no, we're using this cool AI tool when they're playing golf with the other CEOs. And then next week they reach out to speak with you. All of a sudden we had way more interest than we could manage. And we were quite cautious not to bring in a lot of enterprises because enterprises demand a lot from you and they can bully you into kind of building feature sets. And all of a sudden you're very distracted. So we wanted to almost like very carefully vet and the rest we put onto a waiting list. But then we started to realize that to go from a proof of concept and a trial and so on to a rollout with even just one enterprise requires all these other functions, account management, customer support, someone to look at compliance all the time and monitoring for, a lot of stuff effectively. And it was a moment of, and while we were the only ones in the market doing what we do, which is the clinical decision side of the prior roles, and we had this interest, it was a moment to be like, okay, let's double down on this. We've got something. We know what these plans want. It's working. And we just want to continue being in the lead. And that's when we spoke to a few venture capitalists in the US. And I think the one that stood out to us that we really loved was NEA, New Enterprise Associates, based in San Francisco, California. And they're a kind of 40-year-old firm, but they specialize in two things, enterprise and healthcare. And we were lucky to have Mo Masumi, who heads up NEA and heads up the healthcare practice and just brings a wealth of experience. He was, part of the offer was he would join our board, which was, in healthcare, having reputable names, it's all in enterprise selling. It's all about just, can I trust you? Do I recognize a name here? And that helps a lot with customers. So we raised the Series A, and that's enabled us now to, instead of rolling out just one or two, to roll out to four at the same time and still be able to support all the complexity and the chaos that comes with that.
Congratulations on having such a strong product that it was generating those inbound referrals from early customers. And let's try to wrap this into a few pieces of advice for other founders, because I know a lot of people tune in who are in the midst of fundraising or trying to think through it. And you approached your most recent round when you had really good validation data of the amount of demand. And it sounds like your utilization of funds was really clear, right? Like you had laden pipeline that was ready to go. And it was really just a case of we like invest X, you're likely to get Y. With that first investment, I'm sure it was harder because it was much earlier. And you mentioned you got connected with Sequoia. But what advice do you have for founders that are trying to get that first tranche of funding? Like, how did you meet them? Was there anything you learned going through the process that you wish you'd known ahead of time?
Yes. My advice is generally an accelerator, right? So often a lot of the larger funds of recognized names, they can go early, but they don't go earlier than $2 or $3 million typically. And I think sometimes for founders that are still figuring it out, and even we're still figuring it out right now, it's just a spectrum of figuring it out. But I would say if you can get into an accelerator, that just makes your life a hell of a lot easier because even fundraising is a skill. And the first time I tried to fundraise actually was before I got into accelerator, I actually tried to fundraise a pre-seed. I was terrible at it. I took 80 meetings, no one said yes, but an accelerator said yes. And all of a sudden you just get into the accelerator and then everything's wired and it's done. You don't have to worry about the shepherding a herd, right? So you can focus on just building, right? Your paycheck is covered for now. You've got a year of just trying to build, right? So my advice is if you can get an accelerator, if you're lucky to have a network of angels already or some or kind of friends and family that can do that, then do that first. But then if you're then thinking about a seed raise, I would say there's no metrics you can give. I think it's just about given your space, how do you demonstrate that there is very clear signs of something here, right? It doesn't have to be PMF. It's just you can prove there is a product market fit, effectively. And product market fit is 100 definitions, I think. One of them is just, you'll know it when you're at product market fit and there's more like specific ones around customers beating a path to your door and so on. It varies, I think. But it's just signs of, but at the seed, it's more about signs of interest. So if this is consumer, that you're having like 10 people reuse the app every single day, right? They don't have to pay you. They're just these high levels of usage activation. If it's enterprise, it's three or four enterprises that an enterprise is very slow. They don't like wasting their time. They're always distracted. So if you can get some of them to commit to just even letting you go behind the scenes and shadow or commit to a proof of concept or something, that's usually enough. And especially if you can tell a good narrative around why this will convert into a high ACV contract and why there's more enterprises like that, You don't even necessarily have to have signed them or anything. It's just more you can point to a market, to a function or something that is, that spend exists. So I think at the seed, it's about some activity, some interest that shows something there, plus a good story around that. As to why, I think Sequoia says this quite well, to be an outlier company, it's like you got to have this ambitious vision. And I think it's about not being scared to say, this is what we're doing now. And this is where phase two looks like. And phase three is a $1 trillion company. Like, that took me a while to get. I think I need to get a lot of fundraising out of the way to almost feel like, I felt like a fraud. Like we're nowhere near $1 trillion. It's impossible.
But you have to channel your inner American and just let naive positivity flow through you.
Exactly. And you got to have a, because they want to know that, because they're trying to hit home runs, right? You've got to have a story where you get above $100 billion evaluation. And to have the confidence to do that just shows that for them, it's like you're thinking that far ahead means if everything else is right, you're still going to have that stamina to go that whole way. And that's what they want to see as well.
So Abdel, at Amazon, we're customer obsessed. And we haven't talked a lot about your customers yet. Can you share a success story or two of any healthcare organizations that are benefiting from your products?
Yes. So hopefully in September, so we're going to go public with a few names and case studies. But in the meantime, I can speak about them. Payer organizations or health plans, so to speak, are actually quite a fragmented market. So there's the actual health plans that you may recognize, United or Blue Cross of whatever state. Then there's this whole services layer that carves out pieces of a health plan to do as a kind of a business process or a service. The ones that for us is delegated utilization management entity that get health plans to outsource all of their prior authorizations to them. That's been the vast majority of our success, mainly because their entire cost of goods sold, their COGS of the business, is usually labor, right? And they're feeling the squeeze with the cost of labor going up and just more administration headache. So for us, they're smaller than a large health plan, so they move faster and you can prove ROI. So for us, that's been the bulk of the initial success. And I start with our design partner. That's been since May last year. And around about October time is when we first got the first prior authorization processed by our AI nurse, end-to-end, for a real case, right? So we're HIPAA compliant, the infrastructure figured out, and so on. And for us, it was, they only gave us 2 or 3 nurses to use at the start, right? Because they were like, we're not sure, understaffed, and so on. And then a few more iterations later, over a course of a weekend, I think they added entire 30 nurses, because it crossed that chasm where it was like, wait, nurses were getting upset that other nurses had access to it, and they were moving faster through the caseload than they were. And then all of a sudden that kind of click, and it was like, okay, we've got something here that's now actually valuable. And they're seeing the average cases go from about 10.5 for outpatients at least to about 25 to 30. And there's a huge variability there, but you can see that's like a 2x, right? So for an army of 30 nurses, you're doing the output of 60 nurses. And a nurse costs about $150,000 a year all in to the organization, right? So for each nurse, you're getting an extra $150,000 in value, right? And times that by 30 or 50 or 60, however that organization is, you can get a sense of what the value to the enterprise is. And we're keeping pushing that number up. Our goal is to get that up to 1,000 per nurse, right? Which means AI is handling almost all of it, just the parts that need, the cases that need human review, get that human review. So that's one example. We've added 2 or 3 more, again, very similar product, very similar cases, and hopefully announcing those case studies later in September, an event.
Excellent. So how have you grown as a leader since founding Anterior? We talked about the fundraising. When you look in the mirror and you think about how you show up for the team, how has that changed since day one? And how do you think about your role as CEO in motivating the team and keeping them aligned and motivated by the mission?
Oh boy. I think the more I do, the more I realize I don't know. And you look at these technology greats, whether it's Bezos at Amazon or Elon Musk and so on, and they talk about how hard it is and how tough, being like, okay, it can't be that bad. It's hard. And I think the hardest thing about it is you've got to get across the journey to start, you've got to get 100 key things right. And you can't go wrong in any one of them because you could kill your company. And on the micro level every single day, there's 100 things you can possibly focus on and only 3 matter. And it's very hard to tell which 3 things that only you as the CEO can do, only you as the leader can do, and what do you give to others. That's just as a broad setback. That's what I've realized is the key skill here is about delegation, prioritization. You hear these things as buzzwords usually, but it is actually that skill and just keep on working on that skill. Another thing I learned was that I'm a bit of a perfectionist, right? That sounds like one of those fake flaws that people have, but in the sense of, I find it hard to give things to other people to do. But I realized when you can just trust, and the first week or two, they might not figure it out. But then after that, I realized they're better than me, right? Like, it's realizing that you've got to find people that the bits that you're doing, my job is to like fire myself from every single function that I'm doing, right? So every time I realize I'm spending a lot of time here, it's about time to now see who else can pick up that mantle and do it better than me. So my job is almost like as an enabler. Like, we have our cultures here at Anterior, and one of the things we say about leaders is they should be levers, not leaders, right? Their job is to be a lever that enables others to do the job better than they are, and then have that kind of direction they're pointing at. So I think there's just a constellation of things that I'm learning. Some of them are hard to quantify. Maybe come back in a year.
We'll do a round two. There's a bit of a double entendre there. Leaders are levers to increase the leverage of others. And leaders are levers, meaning you build something that can run without you and then you leave it. And it keeps running. Ooh, it keeps running without you when you leave. What's one thing you've done to get better at prioritization? You mentioned that like prioritization is so hard. Have you sought out mentors? Have you thought about like what's something you've done to help with that?
Yes. Mentors is a tricky one because you hear this advice, get a mentor, CEO, coach, whatever. And I find it's really hard because there's so much context to the business that it's very hard to find someone that's always there. So with mentors, I treat them as typically as I have a question about a particular area and I go to experts in that area with a very clear set of questions because the most successful people are often busy. They can't just usually be around learning about all you do and just kind of giving you mentoring. It's usually experts. So for example, evals was a thing we were thinking about a lot. So we went to a person that does evals. Or operations, hiring people. There's a great operators there, my investor network and so on, that I go to with specific questions. When it comes to prioritization every single day, what I try to do is I realized quality time to think. I heard this quote. The whole concept was generally about you need time away from the business to actually know what to do and how to prioritize. And I've made sure now, like from 6 a.m. and what I get up early, 6 a.m. to about 12, it's undisrupted. It's completely free. Knowing that meetings will always start after 12 or 1 and back to back basically after that. But in the mornings, and I try to start with an empty bank page, which is just brain dump. There's like morning journals or whatever, just everything out. And then I use Notion, right? Notion has this AI feature where I just transcribe my thoughts at it, like 200 words per minute. It's all this blurb and I get to summarize, like, what are the key themes here? And he comes up with 4 or 5 key themes. And then I realize, this particular aspect, I need to, and then I schedule it in the kind of maker manager routine, which is, there's time when you're doing stuff and there's time when you're like basically planning or managing or delegating. Quality time, basically one-on-one, taking a step back. That is helping with prioritization. I can't say I've got it completely figured out.
Yeah, indeed. It's a journey. Adele, we're going to have to do a round two, I think. It's been a blast. Thank you so much for joining me today on the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. Thank you.
Absolutely. It's flown by.
Thanks for joining us today for the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. If you want to get in touch with AWS, please check out our show notes where you can find a link. If you enjoy the podcast, the best way to support us is to share it with your colleagues and friends. We also really appreciate your reviews and ratings wherever you listen to podcasts. We love hearing feedback from our listeners, so please don't hesitate to get in touch. Again, you'll find all the details in our show notes. See you next week.